the OTB Podcast Network.
They spoke about your arm not being down beside your side. I mean, this is not Irish dancing.
OTB Sports Radio.
Basketball would have been my main game.
The brand new sports radio station from Off the Ball.
That's my point. Don't play for us if you're a proud Englishman.
Now broadcasting 24 hours a day, live on the Go Loud app, Alexa.
You have a whole new world of possibilities.
Google Home, TuneIn, and offtheball.com/radio.
This is OTB Sports Radio. The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now, welcome back. So we are reviewing the Sunday Papers. We have with us Bernard Jackman, Leinster and Ireland player, formerly as well head coach at Grenoble in France and the Dragons in Wales. And Sarah O'Donovan will join us as well. Camogie All-Ireland winner with Cork, also represented Dublin. Bernard, you're there. How you doing?
Yeah, very good. Thank you, Joe.
Great to have you with us. We're just getting connected with Sarah, so she should be along in a few moments' time. Are you working from home? Are you heading out to the office here and there? What's life been like?
Completely working from home. So I'm in financial services industry, selling data to the financial services. So 9 to 5, conference calls pretty much on the hour. And it's been good to have that structure, to be honest. Obviously frustrating not being able to get out and meet people, but very, very, I suppose, conscious that I'm lucky to have a job and to be operating, not as normal, but still operating. And it's been good, to be honest. Trying to take the positives out of it in terms of just spending a bit more time at home, you know. But obviously it's not ideal.
No, to say the least. I'm no expert, but the financial data is not good, Bernard. I know that much.
No, it's not. It's not. But I think it's even more important now for the traders and investors to have that data quickly and have it accurate, because there's so much fluctuation in the markets that their decision making has to be a lot more reactive than maybe normal. But no, it's not. It's all the signs of a huge economic recession across the world. But we'll see how it all unfolds.
To start with the Sunday Papers then, and we'll have Sarah O'Donovan with us as soon as her Skype kicks into gear, which hopefully it will in the next minute or two. The main section of the Sunday Independent is worth just touching on. Yeah. Simon Harris has done an interview here, and he's talking about various things. Like, he has signalled that schools could be reopened one day a week before the end of term this summer, but has most certainly, from a sporting perspective, ruled out mass gatherings for the foreseeable. For instance, he says that pubs are unlikely to reopen to maximum capacity, packed with people, until there's an effective vaccine or effective treatment for the disease. And that's not expected until early next year. And then he says of sport, I think some of the decisions taken by the GAA seem very sensible. It's highly unlikely we're going to be seeing very large kinds of mass gatherings this year. Could you get to a point where you can't have massive GAA matches, but you could have local kids having a kick about safely? That's the sort of space that we're in, that we need to work our way through. So based on that, very simply, we're not going to have matches in front of crowds this year. I think everybody had pretty much come around to that opinion and understanding anyway, though, Bernard.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I suppose following from around the world, I mean, that's been this week, there's been probably more clarity on it. Not so much clarity in terms of when or what, but just how people are thinking. And even in France yesterday, I read a very good article with the thought process being that probably pro sport or elite sport in front of crowds is maybe summer 2021. But I suppose that, you know, everyone's into the unknown. But I think from a pro sport point of view, it's getting back playing behind closed doors is going to be the key. And I think from a public point of view, people who love sport, well, it won't be the same as being able to go and watch in the stadiums. At least there'll be something. I certainly am fed up of looking at reruns, to be honest. And and I think that all the elite players across all wide variety of sports, whether you're an Olympic athlete or an intercounty GAA player, we'll be just looking to get back and participate again, and hopefully that's something that comes, sooner, because no sport until 2021 will be very difficult. And it'd be great to see some reintroduction of just the kids playing, and I saw no dressing rooms and just meet on a pitch, and I saw talks of just disposable gloves and things like that. But it just from a public health point of view, just getting them back out and running around and being active again as soon as possible, as soon as it's safe to do so, obviously. But I think that'd be great. And that's probably more important than pro sport at the moment, just because, you know, of the physical health of the majority of the population.
Yeah, in some respects, I miss almost amateur sport happening around the country more than pro sport. It's such a core part of the community. It's such a lovely thing if you're having to walk through a park to stop and watch a game happening. And I can't wait for that to come back, every bit as much as pro sport, to be honest, if not even slightly more in some ways. Tony Houlihan was on the Late Late Show on Friday, and he was making the point, really, that in terms of easing restrictions, nothing like this has happened before. Nothing, this disease has never been in existence before. So really, there's no blueprint they can turn to. It's not in a book. They don't know how to ease restrictions. They don't know the consequences of, for instance, going back to school for a day from a social distance versus going back for 3 days from a social distance. They don't know the consequences of opening takeaway coffee shops en masse around the country. So you can imagine how this is going to be so slow and inch by inch, because each new easing of the restrictions will have a set of consequences, and there'll be a 2 to 3 week lag before we know what those consequences are.
Yeah, I think I watched that interview. I think Tony Houlihan has been exceptional and inspirational, and he's humble enough to say they don't have all the answers. And as you said, it may be, you know, a slight release of the lockdown to see how that goes, and maybe extend it further or come back again. And that's, as you know, as you said, it's the lack of being there before, the lack of evidence, that we're all in a kind of a taste and see you know, period. But look, I think the most important thing is that all the authorities, whether you're sporting or business, you listen to the medical advice, and we all row in together and try and get through this as best we can with least amount of fatalities.
You can give us the players' perspective on this. From a GAA point of view, for instance, if we can get to a point where the matches can happen behind closed doors, and arguably that's more complicated in some respects than the Premier League happening behind closed doors. Premier League players can quarantine in a hotel. GAA players might be working in hospitals Monday to Friday. There's a whole extra layer of complication there. But say we get to a point where public health officials turn around to the GAA and to League of Ireland and all the various stakeholders and say, you can have matches behind closed doors. The GAA players obviously are amateur. There's no great need for it to go ahead in, you know, with regards to their salaries or their income. They would be doing it just for the sheer joy, I suppose, of doing it, and maybe with the aim of winning an All-Ireland. As a former player, would you be happy enough to go back behind closed doors if you were a GAA player, and the other option was, well, we just do nothing until the following summer?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, look, most pro players play because they enjoy the competition of the game. And it's working together with your teammates to try and, you know, put a performance in, win a game, and beat an opposition team. So while there's mortgages and you know, other, it's your career as a professional player, like, never forget why you started to play. It's that love of a game.
I bring that up because the pros probably won't have a choice in the way that the amateurs will.
Yeah, absolutely. But my point would be that the amateurs will still want to get out there and play. I mean, I spoke to an inter-county footballer yesterday, and, you know, they're training away via Zoom calls, programs in the back garden with little bits of gym equipment. But it's to play, you know, and they'd love to play in front of big crowds, and they'd love to, you know, have their day in the sun where there's live games on TV. But that's the last 10%. I mean, you know, the core motivation for most people to play sport is, you know, either to be part of a team fighting for a cause, or the actual competition of, you know, performing against an adversary or an opponent, either as an individual or as a team. So I think players will be mad to play. I think that I don't see that being an issue at all, because I think, as I said, that's what drives people. It's that level of competition and, you know, working together to try and achieve something.
There's lots of good stuff in the papers today. Wayne Rooney has started as a columnist in the Sunday Times in the midst of all this. And I have to say, about a month into it, he's still doing really good stuff. Today is the first time in many respects where he's not been writing about COVID in one way or another. He's actually just talking about the art of finishing, the art of forward play, and using his own career to take you through lots of fascinating things, really. It's a brilliant insight, I suppose, primarily into the way he played the game, but you can deduce lots of other bits through that. But he basically, Bernard, takes you through how he played the game, how he wanted to play the game, and how sometimes he was forced to play the game.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's fascinating for a guy, you know, who scored 363 goals in his career to say he's not a natural goal scorer. And he kind of goes through the different, you know, challenges of being an out-and-out goal scorer. I mean, he praises, you know, Gary Lineker or Van Nistelrooy. Sorry, he categorizes them as being your six-yard men who knock it in the back of the net. But he said he really struggled with the whole psychology of being patient enough, you know, as an out-and-out. He liked to be involved. He liked to get touches on the ball. And he said that was probably the challenge for him was, you know, the really natural goal scorers are happy to wait 60, 40 minutes, you know, with very little involvement, but being in the moment. It's kind of like a goalkeeper. You know, we hear about goalkeepers, you know, they're playing with a good team, they're dominating territory and possession, but their concentration levels need to be bang on for when they're called upon. And he kind of, you know, he's the same, I suppose, philosophy around a striker. And, you know, just that understanding of your role is to be in the right place at the right time and be selfish to a certain extent and not do the work that he probably felt he's being dragged into. And he just says in two of his 13 seasons for United, where he was number nine, he scored 34 goals in both campaigns, which is obviously phenomenal. Mm. But he never once came off the pitch feeling he played well. Yeah. Getting man of the match awards against AC Milan, etc. But in his mind, feeling that he probably hadn't contributed enough. And it's a constant battle. And, you know, I liked as well where he went through, you know, his development as a free kick taker. And, you know, there's little things that as young players can probably take from it that, you know, he started off, his initial, I suppose, thought process was he needed to be able to smash it. But when he was younger, you know, he basically started off with a bag of balls in Everton with no goalkeeper, just practicing the shape and the accuracy that he needed, and eventually kind of built it up. So it's that process of, you know, understanding you've got to go through the various steps before you can become, you know, elite at something. And, yeah, just it's a good interview, you know, talking about Messi versus Ronaldo. Obviously, he played with Ronaldo, you know, and again, it's probably his own preference for, you know, the type of player he liked. He's very praising of Ronaldo, but he said, you know, it's the Messi and the Paul Scholes and the, you know, Xavis that probably are the guys that he aligned himself to most.
Yeah, it's really well done. And so he breaks it up into different sections: psychology, movement, finishing, tricks of the trade, Messi versus Ronaldo. And again, the psychology thing is amazing that in his, as you said, his two seasons at number nine, he scores 34 goals. He's a phenomenon there. And he doesn't like it. He walks off the pitch every time feeling uninvolved, like he hasn't justified his contribution. On the movement thing, angle, he loves Van Nistelrooy. Parts of this are almost a love letter to how good Van Nistelrooy was as a striker. And he talks about learning from Ruud about not having any fear and making runs. Just do it. Don't get frustrated if the ball doesn't come to you. And on finishing, he talks about composure. And this was really interesting as well. So he said, you know, initially he's talking about psychology, then the movement. And then he goes on to say, OK, so say you're in position and now you're in front of goal with the ball. He says, then it's about your approach to the ball. You can lengthen or shorten your stride. Depends how the ball's coming. But what you're looking to do is arrive at it with composure. And it's one of the hardest things to teach. He says, and I'm sure Danny Welbeck will thank him for this. I always remember saying to Danny Welbeck, Danny, when you go through every time you shoot, you're falling over. Just steady yourself. Slow yourself down. And Rooney says, that last step, that's your chance to gain control of your body. If you're still running at 100 miles an hour, it's impossible. I think that's a fantastic... I'd say there's probably light bulbs going off for 11-year-old strikers now who are in on goal quite a bit and maybe rushing it and not taking that extra little moment of composure, which probably applies to most sports at those key pressure moments, to take that heartbeat of a moment and compose yourself.
Yeah, well, that's what they say. Like, the elite players always look like they've more time than the non-special. And he was obviously had that ability. And again, you know, it's he rarely score goals by hitting the ball as hard as you can. Mm. Out of his 363 goals for club and country, he reckons only three of them, you know, he really put full power behind him. And it's that ability, as you said, to be able to have that extra split second to see where the opportunity is or where the space is. And he also talks about Solskjaer. You know, Solskjaer used to score a load of goals through shooting through the defender's legs. And he asked him about that. And Solskjaer kind of told him what the thought process was behind it. And he started to develop that into his game. So, yeah, it's the first article I've read by him, to be honest. And it's really interesting, yeah, but it's also simple and logical. But again, hopefully, you know, people who are, you know, soccer players or in other sports can just realize that, you know, even the best, you know, they've got a very simple way of looking at the game and breaking it down, and you know, it's definitely useful for sure and interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. Well, I can recommend the last month of stuff if you want to go back and look.
Yeah,
he's more thoughtful about the game than I had anticipated. Rooney just burst on the scene as this kind of street footballer instinct. That was how I saw him as a 16, 17-year-old when he arrived. And actually, it turned out, and he wrote about it in his first column, that as a kind of 12, 13-year-old, he was playing for the Everton under-16s. So he was obviously a prodigy. But he wasn't able to bully anyone physically at that age. So what he did was dig out old VHS tapes, such was the world then, of the likes of Jari Litmanen, who was playing number 10, and studied their movement when he was 13 years of age. Like, actually made a point of watching Litmanen over and over again and studying his movement. So he's thinking about his game far more than you might have thought, the way he burst on the scene, so kind of brilliant and brash. And it's clear he wants to play number 10. He's also quite modest at the end. He basically just says, so I'm not a natural goal scorer. How did I end up as the top goal scorer for England and Man United? And he simply says, time. I played for United for 13 years, England for 15 years. I had time to break those records. And looking back, I should have scored more. So pretty humble, I would say, as well. And he's not overplaying his talents.
No, and he was exceptional. His results score for himself, particularly the tally score talks for itself. But particularly as we know how selfless he was and how much, you know, work he did other areas of the field. And he does come across humble. I'm going to look back and get a copy of the previous articles he's written, because I did find it, you know, fascinating and very interesting.
Yeah, no, he's made a good start to life as a columnist. I'm sure he's getting help, and I'm sure he's asking people advice and everything else, but he's got stuff to say. One very last thing, because I thought this was interesting as well. I used to practice finishing when I was tired. So at the end of a training session, I'd get a goalkeeper and Eric Steele, the goalkeeping coach, and I would do 5 sets of 6, a little sprint, then a shot. By the 5th and 6th rep of each set, you were out of breath. If you learn to finish when you're tired, it's so much easier when you get a chance and you're normal. There you go.
Simple. Yeah, and again, goal kickers would do that in rugby. Line out throwers, you know, recently and probably as the art developed, they would have implemented an element of that into their training. So some would be just pure technique, and other would be to have your heart rate up over 120, you know, when you're throwing the ball, because that's how it is in a match. But it's just another little insight into how we prepared.
And would you have done that with your throwing, got your heart rate up and then practice your throwing?
At the end. Yeah. So when Enda McNulty came into Leinster, and we were doing one-on-one sessions, he would have introduced that to us, to be honest. And it made perfect sense, but sometimes it takes an outsider to, to basically awaken you to, you know, what the best practice is. But we would have done that. And now that would be common practice. Not all of it under fatigue, but certain elements of your training week, you would make sure you try and simulate as close to possible, you know, what match situation is going to be like.
And did it make a difference in games?
Yeah, it did, yeah. It gave you more self-belief and confidence of feeling better prepped, for sure. You know, and there was ways then you tried to get your heart rate down and try to get, you know, more control of your visualization and your thought process. So yeah, it did help.
Yeah, I'm thinking as well of Joe Schmidt after that New Zealand defeat at Lansdowne or at the Aviva Stadium, doing the, was it 2:28 that phase, that period, to train them over and over again to deal with that onslaught over that period of time.
For sure, yeah. And that's now teams are doing 4 minutes, you know, 4.5 minutes, because, you know, there has been opportunities, there are times when the ball has been played that long. So, I think the game is all, and training methods are evolving all the time.
Now, welcome back. We're continuing with the Sunday Papers. Bernard Jackman is with us, Leinster and Ireland player, formerly head coach at Grenoble and the Dragons. And Sarah O'Donovan as well is with us, Camogie All-Ireland winner at Cork, represented Dublin as well. Sarah, hoping you can hear us okay now. How you doing?
I'm good. I think this is a better connection now.
Excellent. I was just asking you before the news there, we had touched on Wayne Rooney's article and we had touched on Simon Harris's interview in the Sunday Independent. He certainly was dampening down any expectation of fans in stadiums this year. So I had put it to Bernard and he was of the opinion that players will want to get back in there and get playing rather than not play at all. Would that be your expectation as well?
No, I think it's slightly different. I think it's a bit naive for players to assume that they will be immune to this. the knock-on effect for their families would be huge. You know, we're talking about the bus drivers, the physiotherapists, and Joe Brawley alludes to that in his article. Our sport is too close contact for us to consider that we can play the game and not affect other people.
Mm. Yeah, well, I suspect we'd be talking about this if public health officials gave it the thumbs up. So it's very much on that proviso. Obviously, if it's not safe, then it wouldn't happen. It's almost if there comes a point, and there probably will come a point at some stage, where public health officials say it is okay to get back in there. If that means doing it without crowds or not doing it at all.
Again, I read Damon Cahalan today with Dennis Walsh, and he makes the point that you do it for your family, or, you know, you do it for your peers. So what is the point in doing it? And I know that's probably very black and white, but yeah. I suppose the joy is in seeing other people celebrate your celebrations as well. I think it would be difficult for players to get as much joy out of it without people actually supporting them.
Interesting. I presume this will be done, you know, the GPA will consult all the players, and ultimately the players will decide when it comes to a GAA championship, Sarah.
I agree that the players will have a distinct amount of responsibility in determining whether it goes ahead. But I would assume that the logistics of it are just too much. The physiotherapists, the doctors, the bus drivers, the structure that requires this championship to go ahead, too many people affected if something was to go wrong and a player was to be tested positive.
Yeah, it's probably a fair point as well. So, look, we'll have to see. At the moment, certainly there'll be no fans involved. And as you probably rightly point out, even the logistics of trying to do it behind closed doors will be exceptionally difficult, especially with amateur players who can't be quarantined away in a hotel the way Premier League players can. Let's move on. So, Bernard, I know you both like this piece. Brian Ashton on page 5 of the Sunday Independent with Brendan Fanning is a very interesting read. He was coach of Ireland. It was meant to be for 6 years. In the end, it was only for one. And Brendan Fanning sat down and had a chat with him, I presume through Zoom or Skype or one way or another. And it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's a fascinating interview. I mean, Brian Ashton, he's 73 years of age. He's been coaching for 51 years, now works as a coaching consultant, is actually mentoring some coaches in soccer for the English Premier League. And, you know, he presents a lot on coaching conferences for rugby coaches as well. He's a bit of an outlier. He's got a very, different view of the game. Actually, and he was kind of out of fashion for a while, but it's actually come full circle, and more people now are actually starting to coach the way he believed the game should be coached, which was, coaching an element of chaos. I mean, Leinster under Stuart Lancaster would certainly have some philosophies that are aligned to Ashton's vision. I mean, Brendan wrote a great book a couple of years ago now about the passage of Irish rugby from amateurism to professionalism, and some of the interesting parts of that were around, I suppose, Brian Ashton's spell as Irish coach. I was actually in the squad then as a 19 or 20-year-old in 97, and he didn't last very long. He signed a 6-year contract. Now, in fairness, he got an illness, he got shingles, but I think he only did about a year. But, you know, he was coming from Bath, where he had players like, Jeremy, Gus Scott, a very successful team, much more professional than probably we were. We were just in the transition from amateur to professionalism, and, you know, his level of disdain for our skill level and our fitness at the time was pretty obvious. You know, it was a tough job for him because he wanted to play this open, free-flowing game, and we didn't have the skill set to do it. So it kind of goes through that. But really around kind of how you have to coach players now and give them ownership, give them leadership, you know, embrace their ability to understand the game themselves and teach them through the game. So for anyone who's interested in coaching, you know, he's a rugby coach, you know, by nature, but he has evolved into being a coach educator and someone who understands how coaching should happen in order to, I suppose, empower the players.
Well, Brendan writes that Brian Ashton was reveling in chaos before it became a buzzword. He's all about empowering the players, seeing how they'll react to different situations as opposed to rigid game plans that you must stick to no matter what. And early on in his Irish tenure, 1997, there's a Limerick get-together, and there was a simple passing drill in the initial stages of the Irish training session. And Brendan Fanning writes, "Ireland were awful, and it wasn't like they were having a bad day either. Ashton had a pained look on his face. This coach was all about creative attack, ball in hand, day one, and he was dead in the water. One of his fellow coaches, former All Black Mike Brewer, recalled subsequently, "I remember after that first week in Limerick, he said to me, 'Jesus, I don't know if I've made the right decision here.'" So what Ashton wanted to do with the ball, it seems, was not something that the Irish players were capable of doing. Is that fair, Bernard?
Yeah, I think so. At the time, look at the game at club level, you know, the All-Ireland League and provincial level was more around, you know, set piece and kicking game and pressure. And he wanted to be able to run from your own 22 if you saw it was on. And we didn't have the skill set or fitness levels to do it. I actually was one of the players who missed out. There was a tour to New Zealand that summer and I had a groin injury and I missed out on it. And it's probably saved my career because there was a lot of people who went on that tour who never recovered from the psychological damage that they suffered, you know, losing to third division NPC teams. And also, you know, Ashton was very hard on them. I mean, you know, he didn't tolerate poor skill set. He didn't tolerate poor fitness levels. And unfortunately, the Irish players, the majority were coming from an environment where, you know, they weren't getting that stimulus. They weren't getting that skills coaching. They weren't training hard enough, or certainly to the level of the English Premiership clubs at the time. But, you know, he coached England actually in the 2007 World Cup final. So he bounced back after the Irish probably setback. And during the World Cup, there was a player coup against him. Mm. You know, but it's interesting him speaking about that. He said that he met the players, you know, after they lost to South Africa in the group game. He met decision makers the night before and he empowered them to present on his behalf the next day to the players. And in fairness, like having decision makers now would be very common and they would be the ones who would deliver the message in most elite teams. But back then, it seemed to be, you know, a sign for some of the players in the squad that he wasn't strong enough. He didn't know what he wanted to do. And it actually backfired on him. And there was a bit of a revolt. And, you know, they got to the World Cup final. But after that, you know, the word got out of camp that the players had actually taken over. So, you know, it's a pretty interesting example of someone trying to empower players and give them ownership. Mm. But yet, at the time, the level of maturity in the group wasn't strong enough to realize that was actually a skill in itself. And, I mean, Declan Kidney was kind of a little bit like that as well. I mean, you know, he wasn't your tactician or really strong technical coach, but he was very good at creating an environment where, you know, the players had the tools to set the game plan. And yeah, Ashton, you know, he's bounced back from that, as I said, to now being, you know, seen as a bit of a visionary. And a lot of coaches are going to him looking for advice on how to coach, which is amazing.
And do you buy his recollection of 2007, that it was him empowering the players as opposed to them revolting against him?
It's a bit like in the Clive Woodward. I mean, there's a story about Clive Woodward where at extra time in the final of the World Cup final that they won, he went to go onto the field to talk to the players in the huddle, and Martin Johnson said, you know, "Stay back. You know, we don't want to hear from you. We have this." And, you know, he says that was, he knew then that he'd done a great job, you know, coaching the team and empowering the leaders. But look, Ashton definitely would have been the type of guy who would have had that meeting with the decision makers and leaders and said, "Look, could you guys figure it out?" That's his way of doing it. So I do actually believe that he did that, and he saw that as being a positive. But I can also see how a certain group of players who were used to being spoon-fed or want direction saw that as a weakness. I mean, it happens not all the time, but it's happened a lot.
Yeah. Sarah, what jumped out at you about this piece? I know you liked it as well.
Really liked it. I suppose having played with a number of different teams, you get used to personalities and you see different managers and what they bring to a situation. A manager like Ashton, I would have had one previously. He would have trusted me implicitly and I would have always played a lot of ball on the pitch with him in charge. But he made other girls incredibly uncomfortable because he didn't spoon feed them the way Bernard is talking about. And he ended up having kind of the players who were really comfortable in his company and the players who weren't used to having so much, I suppose, freedom. And what I liked about Ashton was that he was giving you that freedom. And I know in Wayne Rooney's piece earlier, we talked about Wayne Rooney saying that defensively they got the game plan, but in attack, it was their own decision making. And I suppose with Brian Ashton, he's saying the same. You know, you're giving so much, but at the end of the day, you're building a player who can make decisions for themselves.
Mm. It is interesting as well, Sarah, and Bernard mentioned it, that this type of coaching is very much in vogue now, whereas I suspect 6, 7, 8 years ago, it was all about, especially in rugby, a rigid game plan and detail, and you do this at this point and that at that point. Whereas we seem, you know, you take Lancaster at Leinster, where it is about chaos and reacting. It seems like, certainly for the time being, the Ashton approach has won out.
Which I'm kind of glad about. Yeah.
Sorry, I think it's also how this generation like to be coached. I mean, they want to be empowered. They want to be part of the decision making, and I think it does get the best out of them. Whereas maybe my generation, we wanted, you know, real clarity of our role. I remember, you know, Warren Gatland, who's coached obviously in Wasps with England, coached Wales for a long time, so he understands the Welsh players, understands the Irish players through his experience at Connaughton and Ireland, and obviously coaching Irish players on the Lions Tour. He said the Irish players historically were the ones who wanted to know what was expected in each situation and the thought process behind it, whereas the Welsh in general just wanted to know what to do, and then the English were wanted to be kind of more involved in understanding the why. So it does depend on what generation you have and what the background those players have probably had coming up to that. But definitely at the moment, this generation seemed to really, I suppose, crave for being involved in the overall tactical and not tactical, but also how the overall environment is run.
Mm. There's an amazing anecdote in the midst of it all, by the way, where he's at Bath, I presume, and Jeremy Guscott is there, and Ashton has gathered the group together for a training session, and it says here, Jeremy Guscott set the bar fairly high. His complaint one night about the session content is almost quaint in retrospect. So Ashton says, I gathered the players as you do, and was saying a couple of things, and then Jerry turned around and said, deadpan, is that all you can effing come up with? After 3 days of thinking about it, that was it in the amateur days. I could have written that on the back of a fag packet in 5 minutes. And Guscott walked off and left me with 22 other mostly international players stood there. When I drove home and I reflected, I thought, he's bloody right. We were doing stuff we'd done a couple of weeks before, and it was stuff that they could already do. It was a really salutary lesson. So that's a hell of a story, and Guscott storming off saying, is that all you can do? I don't know, have you experienced much of that, Sarah?
Well, I'm just imagining somebody like Jim Gavin in the situation that he has found himself, obviously winning five in a row, and the types of players who survived if they were to make such a statement like Guscott. From my own experience, yes, there has been days where difficult conversations have been had, and the managers who tend not to appreciate it, you find yourself on the sideline very quickly. And I've probably made a couple of mistakes over the years. No, I have made mistakes over the years where I've read a situation badly, and in hindsight, I should have held my powder a little longer and I'd have got more game time. But, you know, you learn these things in hindsight, I think.
Bernard, as a coach, how do you, and you've been a player, so you've seen it from all angles, how would you react if a Jeremy Guscott type called out your plans one day in training like that?
Yeah, I think you'd embrace it, to be honest, as long as he's a good player. and he's, you know, he's someone who is actually, I suppose, very professional, very elite in his preparation and mindset, you know. And Guscott was always notoriously difficult to get on with, what he had a very low tolerance level for BS. Mm. And he was a performer who performed on the big days. I think that's what you want that. And I mean, if you're asking players to have a growth mindset and to crave feedback, you need to have that mindset yourself. So, and how you react to that, I think, is massive. I mean, if Ashton had kind of tried to turn that against Guscott, or came back the following week with the same type of training session, I mean, that would have been detrimental. But he really embraced that. And he said, yeah, it was crap. We can do better than that. So I think you're looking in a high-performing environment. You're looking for feedback all the time. And, you know, not all feedback is necessarily nice to get. But yeah. I think it helps the whole organization move forward.
Well, it's a really interesting piece. Page 5, there's loads in it on his approach to coaching and empowering players. And to sum up, Bernard, then, it sounds like Ireland got Brian Ashton in 97. It was a 6-year deal. He only lasted a year. It sounds like Ireland just weren't quite ready for him. Maybe 2, 3, yeah, 4, 5 years later, it could have been a different marriage.
100%. Like, he was the right guy in the wrong place or at the wrong time. And definitely, he's, as I said, he's having an influence over what a lot of our coaches are doing at the moment. So he's stood a test of time.
Sarah, if we turn to the Sunday Times, page 24 has two really good pieces, two very different pieces, one by David Walsh and one by Dennis Walsh. We might start with Dennis Walsh. Firstly, the headline is, betting with a credit card is banned in the UK, but why not here? Essentially, Dennis paints the picture of betting in Ireland, betting in the UK, and makes the very simple point that the legislation here certainly is way behind the UK, and that's even developed further in the midst of the COVID crisis.
Yeah, and I agree with the situation that he has portrayed. I suppose from our point of view, because of the association that we have with alcohol here, not necessarily in a good way with sport, we tend to accept as norm things like Paddy Power being our sponsor or having direct access to players and different players having, you know, I suppose it's not that they're outrightly advertising betting, but they're not condoning it. And we sit on a very funny precipice where we're quite happy to talk about two teams and put a sly bet on, but we don't necessarily understand the effects of that in the long run.
Dennis writes here that 800,000 people in the UK use credit cards for betting. 22% of them are problem gamblers. And on Tuesday, what's happened is that a law banning credit card gambling has come into force in Britain. That's not the case here. And Bernard, he's basically painting the picture here. In Ireland, no such legislation exists. None is on the horizon. The 2013 Gambling Control Bill, that was originally piloted by Alan Shatter, still in the works. It's made excruciatingly slow progress so far. It's just before the general election, it had reached stage three of a five-stage process before facing another five stages in the Shannon. And even if that legislation goes through, there's no reference to credit card betting. And the change of legislation in the UK on Tuesday, the word is that's been noted, said a government spokesperson. And before the recent election, the wisdom of such legislation, writes Dennis, was not lost on the opposition parties. In their manifestos, both Fianna Fáil and Labour promised to ban credit card betting, or as Fianna Fáil put it, debt-based gambling. But it does seem like things have moved very slowly. Even there's talk of the establishment of an independent regulator for the betting industry. But like, this is a bill in the first place that dates back to 2013 and hasn't managed to make its way through.
Yeah, it looks like we're behind the curve, to be honest. I mean, you know, the gambling industry is said to be worth about 8 billion. And we're one of the few countries in the EU don't have the independent regulators. But it does seem to be that it's on the way, which is great. And even though, you know, banning credit card deposits maybe isn't on the agenda, you'd like to believe, maybe I'm naive, but I'd like to believe that'd be something that they'd look at pretty quickly and copy what's happening in the UK. But yeah, it's strange that we are a little bit behind the curveball, given that it's probably an industry that's you know, thriving and it's pretty prominent in Ireland. So hopefully they can fast track that independent regulator and start to put some measures in place that brings us up to speed with our, you know, UK and EU counterparts.
Because even towards the very end of Dennis Walsh's piece, the Irish Bookmakers Association, which only represents betting shops and not the online arms of bookmakers, but their spokesperson Sharon Byrne said that credit card betting was discussed at its last meeting in January, and it was agreed in principle by its members that the new ban in Britain should apply in Ireland too. So that's the Irish Bookmakers Association saying that, and we'll have to see what happens. I mean, it won't be, I suspect, top of the agenda for a new government in the midst of what's going on, but it does seem like we're a bit behind the curve there. Back page of the Sunday Independent, Sarah, I know you really liked Sometimes Winning Isn't Everything.
Yes. Eamon Sweeney's piece, really, really enjoyable piece. It talks about the nearly men. And I suppose over the last couple of years, we would see Mayo footballers in Ireland as the nearly men. And there's a great quote in the middle of it, basically saying that you have to be supremely talented to get there and be so close so many times. And I think sometimes we're very quick to throw the boot in at players and teams who just miss by a fraction. So it was a nice reminder that supreme talent exists when you get that close that many times.
Yeah, Doug Sanders and Stirling Moss, they both passed away this week. I thought this was a really clever piece because a lot of people would have seen Stirling Moss and Doug Sanders have passed away. There's a lot going on. You mightn't have been able to draw the team which links the two of them, Sarah, but Eamon Sweeney did that really well here.
Yeah, I also enjoyed the fact that both of those sportsmen were defined not just by their sport, but defined by their, I suppose, enjoyment of life. And Stirling Moss certainly, you know, basically became this kind of niche character and ended up in a Bond film, you know, and despite not winning a world championship, that didn't define him. So again, I loved that link in by Eamon.
Yeah. Bernard, the Doug Sanders putt in 1970 at St Andrews is just one of the most horrific misses imaginable. This was really just to win the Open in 1970 at St Andrews. He was a golfer. It was a three-footer. Eamon Sweeney even writes in the piece, Henry Longhurst on BBC said, so now this is it. This is what people dream about, i.e. he's about to win the Open. You know, there's no sense he was going to miss it. But when you watch back the footage, it's brutal because he's looking over this three-footer and it's going to turn a lot. So he's taking this, you know, a lot of pressure and he knows it's a bit slippery. And he hits the putt and it turns quite a bit straight away. It's a left-to-right putt and takes a bit of a turn right fairly quickly. And he almost instinctively reaches after it with the putter like he's going to hit it a second time when it's moving, like a hockey, you know, like hockey or hurling. And it's the agony of the moment. Like it's there on YouTube. It's almost worth a watch. And it's haunted him because it's all he's known for. But as Eamon Sweeney points out, he was a phenomenal golfer who finished top 10 in every major in 1 year, went really close lots of times, and so was obviously a phenomenon. And yet it's so easy to reduce him to being a choker.
Yeah, it's so cruel. I mean, it's a putt that a player of his ability you would expect to get. And, you know, he won 20 times on the PGA Tour, and he won big playoff games against the likes of Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer. But it is cruel, and that's how ruthless sport is. That the, you know, the abiding memory most people will have of him is missing, you know, one putt, which can kind of define a career. But I mean, he again, you know, it's just his attitude. He didn't really seem to let it get to him. I mean, he splashed out expensive cars, partied hard with Frank Sinatra's members of the Rat Pack. He always had a smile on his face. You know, on his background as well, like he came. You know, he came to the game late. He was a son of a small farmer. He picked cotton as a teenager. And his introduction to the golf game came through searching on golf courses for lost balls, which his brother would sell back to the club professional. I mean, it's not your stereotypical background. And you get the sense from this article that both, you know, both people who passed away this week, Stirling Moss and Doug Sanders, you know, they didn't carry that burden of not being, you know, world champions or not winning a major. They seemed to accept it and appreciated the success they did have, and yeah, you know, lived the life the way they wanted to live it, which is great too. You know, you don't want to see somebody, you know, broken and carrying that regret with them day to day.
Sweeney writes, the career of Sanders showed that the classic nearly man has to be extremely talented, otherwise they wouldn't go so close so often. And later on he says that asked in later life, did he ever think about that putt at St Andrews? And Sanders would quip, only every 4 or 5 minutes, which is the best way to do it, is a sense of humour, you know. And I, what else can he say? I would presume a bit like, I don't know, Mick McCarthy often quips that he knows he's counting down until someone asks him about Saipan when he meets them. I would presume Doug Sanders, Sarah, anytime anyone met him, he was counting down his head until they asked him about that putt in St Andrews.
It's very difficult for as a sports person to accept defeats. I know we've been asked loads of questions in the last while in different quizzes along the lines of what would you change, the game that you'd like to change if you could change the result. And obviously for Doug, that would probably be the putt that he'd love to put away. Mm. But that's sport, isn't it? You know, the knock-on of winning or losing a game, it creates so many different strands in your life. And I think it's important to read a piece like Eamon Sweeney's piece today, because it shows that these two guys who obviously never hit the peak didn't suffer for it, you know, and that's why we shouldn't hold people to that.
Well, he finishes off Eamon Sweeney by writing, if they fell short of the very biggest prizes, they lost little caste in doing so. Like the current Mayo footballers, Jimmy White, the Dutch soccer team of the 1970s and the Waterford hurling team of the noughties, Sanders and Moss proved that nobody remembers who came second, maybe the most witless of all sporting adages. So that's on the back page of the Sunday Independent there. Stirling Moss and Doug Sanders both passed away this week, and both were so close several times over to the ultimate prizes, but never quite got over the line. We'll take a short break. We're back then with the final few stories with Sarah O'Donovan and Bernard Jackman. Now, you're welcome back. Bernard Jackman and Sarah O'Donovan reviewing the Sunday papers this afternoon. And page 6 of the Sunday Independent. Sarah, I suppose one of the very, 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 very few maybe upsides to the papers at the moment is that with so little going on, we're getting to hear from different voices. One of those voices is Jenny Egan, who specializes in canoeing. She is desperate to make the Olympics, well, now next year. She was very close to making London and Rio. It turns out in her category, which is non-existent when it comes to the Olympics qualification, because there are fewer categories at the Olympics, so she has to go in a different one. It's really tough for her to get there, but she's determined to do it. Maybe just tell people about this piece who haven't read it. She grew up really from inside the womb on the Liffey.
Yeah, so it's 17 seasons Jenny has been involved in canoeing, and she has obviously said that the Olympics remains the holy grail, but securing a slot is particularly challenging is what she identifies. And I suppose the real hero in this story is her mum, Angie Egan, who for the first 10 years drove her around Ireland and then Europe to get her into the mix in terms of Irish and European championships. So her story is a story of perseverance, and also the fact that she is being trained by her brother and her fiance suggests that she is an incredibly determined woman, because I don't know if I'd last if either of those two were in charge of my training, to be honest.
Hmm. So in terms of Irish flatwater canoe racing, she's been a trailblazer, writes Sean McGoldrick, who wrote this piece, a full-time athlete since graduating with her degree in 2013. So that's, you know, that's really tough. Full-time athlete since 2013, trying to make the Olympics. She was the first Irish senior athlete to win an International Canoe Federation World Championship sprint medal when taking bronze in Portugal in 2018. Also the first to secure medals at the World Cup and European Championships. What's made her journey so difficult, Bernard, is that unlike a lot of Olympic sports where there are tons of categories, for whatever reason when it comes to canoeing, they seem to bring the number of categories right down. So the event that she's best at is not one she can try to get to the Olympics in.
Yeah, and she's missed out on London and Rio by one place. But yeah, her best event isn't an actual Olympic race. So she's focusing on an event called the K1 500. There are only 13 spots available, but six of them are already being secured by the first five finishers at last year's World Championship, and one spot's already been reserved for the host nation. So, you know, it's really difficult. And, you know, she says that, you know, she much preferred to be in a sport where hitting a guaranteed time gets you in. She has to basically, you know, nail it on a race against competitors. But what I really liked about this was it goes back to when she was, you know, a teenage years. Her mum, you know, drove her all over Britain, and continental Europe, you know, on a ferry with a V-bar to the roof. And, you know, she was the navigator up front before Google Maps. I mean, this is, you know, this is basically, as I said, a 17-year journey with very close family involved. And you just love to see her, you know, achieve her goal. And probably her career deserves an Olympics, given how successful and consistent she's been. So, and the last thing I like about her, I mean, you know, away from the water, she's become an influential figure in the formulation of sports policy in Ireland. She's the only athlete serving on Sport Ireland's Women in Sport Steering Committee, you know, and she's working on policy, focusing on leadership and governance, coaching and officiating, and active participation and visibility. So even though she's very focused on her, I suppose, her sporting goal of making the Olympics and ticking that box, she's also going to give back and is actively doing that at the moment. And we need people like her, you know, who are world-class and are able to combine education with achievement in elite sport, you know, being involved in the future of our sport.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I always, Sarah, particularly admire the athletes, because you remember going to school with them, who did the offbeat sports. I mean, if you played Gaelic games, rugby, football, a lot of people did. You were in the same rhythms of training. You'd see each other training. You'd see each other at school the next day. Your matches were at a certain time. It was the people in the swimming pools at 5 a.m. that I could never get my head around. And, you know, her schedule from an early age, her mum would bring her training 7 a.m. before school, breakfast at the canoe club, then school in Cailleacha de Chiron and Leixlip, then to and from school for lunch, collect her after school, bring her straight to training, and then after training, bring her home where she'd do her homework, study and have dinner, and then do it all again the next day. I often feel in the rugby, GAA, soccer kind of spheres, we don't train as hard often as the swimmers or the canoeists and these individual sports people.
Tennis people as well, you know, the level of training that they go through And also in terms of their mindset to do that consistently day in, day out. It's important to, as I said, recognise Angie Egan in all this, because obviously she was the front and centre in terms of Jenny's accessibility to her sport. So big hugs from mum as soon as this is all over, I think, when she sees back the article.
Did you involve yourself in any individual sports, Sarah?
No, I was terrible at gymnastics, and I was also tried and tested in athletics, but I just wasn't fast enough. So I really admired the players, and actually when we were playing under 17 with Ireland in the UEFA Championships, Katie Taylor would have been on the team at the time.
Right.
And Katie was boxing then, and she would have been 15 at that stage, and she would have been heading off for training herself, boxing in the evenings. Now, we had done a full day's session in Clanshock with our team, and it was fascinating to us that she was going to find another gear and go again. And also we were obviously concerned about her beautiful face and breaking her lovely nose, so there were all those things coming into play at that point. But again, individuals going off, you know, seeing that she was trying to obviously better herself in her sport while trying to play our team sport as well. Mad.
Yeah, because Bernard, on bad days you had someone, I'm sure, to drag you along, and vice versa. When you're on your own out there, you really are in just a battle with yourself at all times.
Yeah, I think it's a far harder career to go down, the career of an individual sport. And even though they try and have a team around them, I mean, at the end of the day, you're the one out there on your own battling the conditions, or battling the competition. So I've absolute massive admiration for them, and I think they're, you know, they're really special, the people who can get to that level and compete against the best in the world.
Well, we wish her well. So her specialist event, the one she's best at, is the 5,000 metre. And to get to the Olympics, she's going to have to do it at the 500 metre distance. So that's a massive difference. And she's trying to compete and get there. So hopefully she does. She's 33 years of age now. She's missed out in London and Rio, and she's desperate to get to Tokyo. So that's Jenny Egan in the Sunday Independent. Sarah, you picked out the travails of Ronaldinho in the Mail on Sunday, page 72 there. I kind of, when this all blew up initially that he arrived in Paraguay, fake passport, I thought, you know, not just as one of these stories that would blow over fairly quickly, but he is potentially, Ronaldinho, in deep trouble. What's going on?
So he arrived in Paraguay, used a fake passport, even though his Brazilian ID card would have got him into the country. And no one can put a finger on or is willing to say why he did that. And it seems from what is going on currently, it relates to money laundering, and there's quite a bigger web involved. He's now under house arrest. Now, the house arrest doesn't seem too bad. He's in a hotel that's 280 euros a night, and he has it to himself, and he has a whirlpool and a swimming pool. And what I found interesting about the piece was that, despite, I suppose, the Jack the Lads carry on, you know, that has kind of gone through his whole career, he's still very much loved, and he seems to be able to get away with murder. Not literally, hopefully, but certainly, you know, he goes to prison. He's in prison, and he becomes the centre of the prison setup. And they're actually crying when he leaves, and no one wants him to leave prison because they've had that much crack. Like, this article is nuts. There was another piece actually towards the end where obviously different players are talking about his downfall. And what I noted was that in 2008, Barcelona sold him because they were afraid that he was actually going to upset the young Messi at that point and derail his career. So people have been looking out for Ronaldinho for a long, long time.
Yeah, that's a quote from Alexander Schleb. He said Ronaldinho eventually sold in 08 because he and Deco used to come to training drunk. They were afraid he would bring down Lionel Messi, Schleb told Volca TV.
The mad article. Like, in terms of where it goes from here, if they were found guilty, and if they were actually pursued individually for this, they could end up in prison for 5 years.
Yeah, no, it's very serious. So he paid the 1.3 million bail. That's why he got out of jail, and he's in this hotel now, chilling out, I suppose, the hotel effectively to himself. But yeah, 5 years in jail, potentially, for Ronaldinho and his brother. And it seems like a fairly complicated operation, whatever's been going on, to what extent he's involved or not, clearly we don't know yet. He was at Bernard for a couple of years, pretty close to the best player in the world. He was doing phenomenal things, and probably just threw away his talent because of his off the field love of partying and turning up to training drunk and all this kind of stuff. But there was a time where Ronaldinho was about as good as it got.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a very good book Damien Hughes wrote, The Barcelona Way, and it kind of covers culturally how toxic the dressing room was before Messi came in, and kind of deals with how they needed to get him out. But yeah, he seemed to be one of these guys who was, you know, gifted in terms of talent, but and made a lot of money, and you know, from the outside looking in, you say he's very successful, but you also wonder, you know, what he left behind. If he had been a little bit more diligent, you know, he could have reached even greater heights.
Over on page 68 in the Mail, then, Billy Walsh is obviously spearheading US amateur boxing. He was planning on the Olympic Games this year. That's now delayed. He's been speaking with Mark Gallagher, and this is on page 68 of the Mail. He's doing fine. He is on his own. He can't come home at the moment because he's applying for his green card. And he said if you leave the country, your application becomes void and you have to start the process all over. So he says, I'm like a cage lion here on my own. He's 56 years of age now. He's been over there 5 years at this stage, Billy. I mean, it still feels in the head relatively recently. But it's been 5 years. And it's kind of interesting to get his take on some of the challenges with the American boxing team. One of them seems to be just convincing the boxers to stay amateur, because he said the American team, they lost all their best boxers from 1 year to the next because of the draw of being a professional. You have fighters who would become national champion at 18 and then they would just sign pro papers the following week. It can be tough to convince them. A lot of our guys come from poor backgrounds, and if there's a big promoter waving loads of dollars, it's very hard to turn that down. And he's almost been using the COVID situation to explain to any of those potential fighters that even if they go pro now, between now and next July, they might have a fight, maybe two tops. So I've told them, wait, get an Olympic medal around your neck and add a couple of zeros to your contract if you do turn pro. So that's where Billy Walsh is. He's in Colorado, seems to be doing okay. None of the US team are over 22 years of age. And what really jumps out in this piece, Sarah, is just the extent to which the US boxing scene had fallen apart from an amateur level. It says here he was astounded how far things had fallen. Not only had no male American boxer claimed a medal at London 2012, but the team itself had only won a handful of fights. Preparation was so shambolic that it emerged fighters had gone into bouts not knowing whether their opponents were orthodox or southpaw. So Billy has gone in there and I would suspect turned things right around. He's replicated a lot of what he did with the Irish team. And they have so much talent over there, you suspect that sometime next year, whenever the Olympics do happen, Billy Walsh will be talked about quite a bit.
So you were talking about him being here 5 years at this stage.
Being gone 5 years, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but in the article it says that, you know, he'd only been there less than a year when he went to Rio and he managed to bring back a gold, a silver and a bronze. Mm. So certainly the trajectory can only go upwards. It's interesting to see that the COVID-19 situation is actually having a positive impact in terms of the pro situation kind of being, I suppose, pushed, and the money not being a guiding factor for boxers now.
Yeah.
And that he's actually able to say to them, listen, this is the Olympics. This is bigger than money. This is bigger than the, I suppose, the draws that come with professional sport. So it's great that somebody of Billy's experience, you know, obviously the 2016 Coach of the Year, is being given this opportunity to work with boxers and not have that professional sport aspect being, I suppose, being a distracting thing for them.
Mm. Yeah, he's one of Wexford's finest, Bernard. It's still kind of galling that he went, unfortunately, but he seems to be doing a really good job there. And he'll have so much talent at his disposal that it seems like all they needed was somebody to harness it. And no better man than Billy Walsh, you suspect.
Yeah, he was always somebody that I certainly enjoyed listening to. I would have spoken to some of the boxers who had been under his tutelage when he was in Ireland, and the respect and you know, the kudos they give him for what he did in terms of, you know, creating a high performance environment. And we saw how there was definitely a drop down when he left. But I was really looking forward to seeing, you know, what he could do with a full cycle going into Olympics. And he still seems to have a very young group of boxers, but he just seems to be able to influence people, you know, in a positive way in terms of their sport, which is boxing, but also in terms of being able to, you know, I suppose, give them better better clarity or better focus on what's important in their life. And he's a great guy, and it'd be great to see him back in Irish sport, because I think you know, his skill set transcends boxing. I mean, he's someone who can, you know, create a structure and an environment and a team around him to influence performance. So, yeah, he's a good Wexford man, and it's always fascinating to read a little bit about him and see how he's doing.
Yeah, I was quite amazed the extent to which the US had neglected their boxing. Like, it's such a rich tradition of boxing over there. Obviously, the pro ranks maybe is where everybody's focused on, but even Mark Gallagher's writing that one of the first things Walsh did was to, well, he drew the 5 Olympic rings prominently in the gym like they had done in Ireland, but he set up a coaches education program, i.e. if you want to have good boxers, you need to have really good coaches around the country. And apparently there hadn't been a coaches education program in the States in over 20 years. Walsh says vital that we got one up and running, because it's the first program run in the States since 1994. We needed the fighters to get better quality coaching. So he's done a root and branch reform there, it would seem. That's Billy Walsh in the Mail on Sunday with Mark Gallagher. Before we go, you had Paul Kimmage, Bernard, in the Sunday Independent.
Yeah, just, he's 30 years since he wrote that book, Rough Ride. And, obviously, he's someone I always look forward to reading every week. And this is obviously a very short article for him. He's not interviewing anybody. He's just looking back. But, you know, Gary O'Toole asked him to, you know, can you at some stage during a crisis rank your top 10 interviews, the whys and the wherefores, and can you then confess to the people you disliked before you interviewed and liked after, and liked before the interview but didn't feel the same after? He didn't actually go and do that. He could be libelous, but I mean, when you look at the people that he's interviewed, Rory O'Porrick, Floyd Landless, John McEnroe, Jimmy Connors, Pete Sampras, Seve Ballesteros, Nick Faldo, the list goes on, and he's just saying, I mean, he's been able to do Zoom interviews and it's keeping the show on the road, but he never liked phones and, face-to-face, if he hadn't done a face-to-face with Rory, he wouldn't have caught him going out to shop for toilet paper and, the tattered carpet in Floyd's living room. Just small things that when you read a Paul Kimmage article, it helps you feel, I always feel that I'm nearly in the room, the colour he can put to it. So, but just a track record over 30 years of the calibre of successful sports people that he's interviewed. I think it would be a fascinating article if he follows Gary O'Toole's advice.
Yeah. who you disliked after you interviewed them that you liked beforehand section. So we're pretty much done. Is there anything else you want to point people towards? Like, the papers are doing incredibly well to get all this out under the circumstances, to say the least.
The volume of articles in the newspaper today that I really enjoyed is tantamount to the amount of work that's being done, and you have to appreciate all of the work that's being done by these really stellar journalists. I suppose from my point of view, the nostalgia pieces, I'm finding them harder to sink in. I think that I remember stuff differently, and things are being tightly tainted now as I watch them back or see them back 5-10 years later, or even 20 years later. So I think I'll have to go reading some fictional books, just to get a break from the nostalgia for a small bit. I don't know if either of you are finding that as well. I just remember things differently. Then, as an example, the Munster hurling final last week between Waterford and Cork was played on RTE. I remember it so differently.
No, it's not as high quality in 2020. Is that what you're saying?
A bit, yeah. And different players and the impact that they had, and the things that they missed or the mistakes that they made. And that's not to say that these are mistakes that we should be picking up on. But I just remember them differently and being. And it is taking the glean off of it, certainly for me.
Okay, well, some fiction for you. We're pretty much out of time. I got to run because we got to make news headlines. Obviously, very important to do so, particularly at the moment. But my sincere thanks to Sarah Dunavan. Thanks a million, Sarah, for making time for us, and Bernard Jackman as well. Bernard, much appreciated. That's the paper review for this afternoon. Short break.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.